talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leute, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, three wonderful new exhibitions on the island to explore as we find out about the Irish manuscripts returning to Ireland on loan for the first time in more than 1,000 years, a Bohemian artist in Dublin, the life, art and legacy of the husband of Constance Markievicz, and to end the show, a new exhibition in Hillsborough Castle, which explores the intimate bond between British royal clients and fashion designers and how the fashion industry has created the iconic style of the British royals. And we begin tonight's show with Words on the Wave. A new exhibition at the National Museum of Ireland is reuniting Ireland with part of its historical intellectual past. Words on the Wave, Ireland and St. Gallen in Early Medieval Europe, brings home 17 rare manuscripts from the legendary Abbey Library of St. Gallen in Switzerland, many of them written by Irish scribes and returning to these shores for the first time in over 1,000 years. It's an exhibition about journeys of people, of books, of ideas and the deep connections between early medieval Ireland, Britain and Europe. And to discuss it, I'm delighted to welcome Matthew Seaver, Assistant Keeper at the National Museum of Ireland. Matthew, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
It's an extraordinary exhibition because it really is a world first, because it's returning these treasures for this exhibition and also showcasing treasures from this incredible collection of early medieval Irish artefacts.
Yeah, I guess what we're trying to do in the exhibition is tell the story of Ireland as it was in the early medieval period, kind of at the world's, as it was described by Colin Bannis, at the world's edge, and its interactions with the Roman world, how writing came to us, how a rich literate culture began here, and then how over time Peregrini, people leaving Ireland either for exile or for scholarship, left for the continent and distributed manuscripts among kind of learned institutions there. And many of these then ended up in Abbey Libraries, and St. Gallen has a particularly extraordinary collection of these books.
So you're reuniting the texts with their cultural homelands.
Exactly.
And providing the context to them as well. And
yeah.
Why are they so significant?
Well, we have everything in this loan from a copy, the earliest copy in the world of Isidore's Etymology, so a 20-volume encyclopedia written in Spain by a cleric Isidore, and that's been copied in insular script in what eventually becomes a distinctive script to the two islands, and fragments of that book, the last remaining fragments, were found bound into another book in the St. Gallen Library. So some Irish scribe copied that 20-volume encyclopedia with all its knowledge about the ancient world, either in Ireland or on the continent in Irish script. So it's everything from that to then fast-forwarding from there to, say, the 9th century, where you have the Priscian, the work of Priscian, which is a book on grammar, the greatest kind of work on grammar at the time. And because Latin wasn't spoken as the native language by the Irish, they were regarded as particularly good grammarians. And what's unique about that manuscript is it contains thousands of interlineal comments and glosses in Latin, but also in Irish. So it's a very rich source for our own language, for the connections between it and the meaning of words, as well as very important marginal comments about the lives of people in Ireland at the time.
I think it also really shows just how much of a European identity we had at that time, that you have these monks and scribes producing works that travel so far across Europe.
Yeah, you've got kind of three kind of waves of these people leaving Ireland, and you've got commentators on the continent saying, are there any Irish people left in Ireland? You've got scholars like Sedelia Scotus, John Scotus, all of whom are tangentially linked to these manuscripts. For example, the Priscian manuscript almost certainly was circulating in the same circles as scholars like Sedelia Scotus, who were in the heart of the Carolingian court and were kind of part of that very rich intellectual culture that the Irish were plugged into, making links between Greek, Latin and Irish.
So this wasn't a dark age at all. This was a time of learning, of the exchange of ideas. And you had these monks as cultural ambassadors spreading learning, art and spiritual practice from Ireland to the Alps and beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose we have what's interesting is then that our dark age really comes with the kind of extinction of these books. Where our own, the rich kind of scriptura that were associated with our own monasteries over time, due to our own political history, many of these books, the earliest copies of them are only now on the continent, whether they're copied by scholars on the continent or whether they're in their original form.
Tell me about some of the Psalters and some of the things that were discovered in you know, extraordinary places. You know, you have a book shrine that was found in a Westmead lake. You have stuff that was found in bogs. It really shows the durability of these and I suppose their importance and significance as well.
Yeah, that's, I suppose, from what I was saying about the disappearance of our kind of literate culture and why there are so many of our books, whether they are in the neighbouring island or on the continent, there are traces from chance discoveries of these books in archaeological finds. And one of the most remarkable of those, I guess, is the Loch Canale Book Shrine, which is our earliest and largest book shrine. Most of the other shrines were held in later years by Gaelic Irish families and they were modified in the later Middle Ages. But this one was ripped apart and deposited close to a Cranog in this lake, only to be discovered by divers in the 1980s. And we don't know what book was in it, possibly a single gospel, something that was related to a saint or an extraordinary person. But what is clear is this really beautiful object incorporated a whole range of different art styles from the kind of ultimate Latin style, which ultimately came from Central Europe, and the animal art style of the Northwestern European world. And it kind of fused these into a particular style of metalwork, which we see in Ireland, and a really, really remarkable object. And the first time it will be fully conserved and put on display and digitally reconstructed by our partners in the Discovery Programme for everyone to kind of manipulate in the exhibition.
Well, actually, let's talk about the exhibition then. It opens at the end of May, so it's running until the 24th of October. So what can people see when they visit the National Museum?
So I think what we were trying to get across in the exhibition is very much a sense of this idea of travelling in both in time and in space. So you're travelling from Ireland, being immersed in that literate culture, looking at the manuscripts which are likely to have come from Ireland itself and are now returning after thousands of years. So you'll see the beautiful Gospel of St. Gall, which is somewhere kind of in between the Book of Duro and the Book of Kells and is a beautiful piece of work. So you'll be travelling through that world, looking at literacy in Ireland, looking at many objects which have never been on display before, which relate to the kind of artwork in those books, the roots of the artwork. And then you'll be looking at this experience of these early travellers from Ireland to the continent and their journey through Europe, being propelled onwards by attacks of, for instance, the Viking raids, and then their eventual arrival in St. Gallen and the kind of treasures of the library there, many of which were then copied by Carolingian scholars who took a particular interest in their Irish heritage. Gaul obviously being originally said to have been a companion of Columbanus, and they being very proud of their Irish roots. And on your way then you will be seeing audiovisual displays some of which will include a kind of a fascinating scientific examination of the manuscripts. So looking at both the physical makeup of the manuscripts, the inks themselves, comparing them to manuscripts in Ireland, which was done by a group called Inks and Skins, which are from UCC and headed up by Padraig O'Machan. And then also looking at ancient DNA. So that's kind of a first for this exhibition. So looking at some of the manuscripts which are likely to be Irish, but which there has always been a question over their ultimate origin. And that is being tested then by Professor Dan Bradley and his student Sive Carrick in Trinity College Dublin.
Brilliant. So it's really making it as accessible as possible for people. It's showing the significance, it's showing the range, but it's also allowing people to kind of get involved as well and get a sense of what was happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we've partnered with Timothy O'Neill as well, the calligrapher, so people will get to have a go at executing their own kind of interlaced patterns. And I guess as an archaeologist and a museum curator, we're kind of standing on the backs of many, many scholars when we're putting on this exhibition, both historians, paleographers, archaeologists. And what we're really trying to get across is the kind of excitement of these connections between Ireland and the continent and in this time period, and get that across to the general public in what is obviously a free exhibition. So a kind of a spectacular and the first very big temporary exhibition we've had in Kildare Street for many years.
So why was St. Gallen so significant then? Why did this become a key hub for Irish cultural influence?
Well, it kind of starts with the association between St. Gall and Columbanus. So Columbanus leaves Ireland in 590, notionally with 12 disciples. And during his in Jonas's life of Columbanus, he mentions a monk called Gallus. We don't know much about his origin. But then we have three lives of St. Gall. And those lives, the earliest says that he received on Columbanus's death, he receives his staff and he founds a hermitage on the Steinach River just above Lake Constance in the shadow of the Alps. The two subsequent lives, which are written by two more St. Gallen associated abbots, they kind of elaborate on that, and they start adding in a more and more kind of Irish backstory. So they say he's from Leinster, that his name may have meant Kellogg. And we know remarkably that by the kind of mid 9th century, there are 28 volumes in the Irish script in the Abbey Library, because they have an Abbey Library catalogue from the 9th century, which lists over almost 300 volumes. Of which 28 are written in the Irish script. And one of these is the translation of the bones of St. Gall from their resting place to a new chapel in the church at St. Gall. So over time, the Irish connection becomes more and more important. And by the mid-9th century, we have the kind of arrival of a Bishop Marcus and his nephew Muingal, who eventually becomes known as Marcellus, and he becomes an important schoolmaster, and he teaches a whole range of kind of prodigies, and St. Gallen becomes a centre of kind of art, music and culture, and a lot of them attribute this to their kind of Irish teacher. So there are multiple sources, and these Carolingian teachers then are very interested in the life stories of Colum Kill, of Blamach from Iona, and so they're copying these Irish manuscripts which are circulating around the continent in their own script, and keeping this remarkable Abbey Library, which you can visit today in the UNESCO site there.
And it's really then becoming this gateway between Irish and continental scholarship. So what do you want people to take away from this exhibition, Words on the Wave?
I suppose what they can take away from it is the kind of remarkable breadth of scholarship that would have been available in Irish monasteries, Abbey libraries at the time, which is now departed and left for the continent. And then how embedded Irish scholars were in that imperial world of learning, which came with the Carolingian Renaissance, and also that how these messages were transmitted, whether it was through art or words, on boats to Ireland and back to the continent again. So whether it's in the form of pottery from the Frankish world or from the Eastern Mediterranean, or whether it's books arriving in Ireland or scholars leaving Ireland back for the continent again. So it's the kind of interconnectedness of these worlds.
And do you have a particularly favourite part of the exhibition?
Well, I suppose there's obviously the it's just so exciting to see the famous marginal poem Isachar an Ghaol Nuch. So it's bitter is the wind tonight. So it's a poem written about the fact that the sea is very stormy and it's unlikely that the Vikings would be able to raid the monastery on that evening, written by this scribe who's copying and making these glosses in the Priscian. That's just a remarkable kind of human in among all this these great works of scholarship on exegesis or whether it's on the Paschal calendar or in among that are these kind of touches of humanity, and I just find that so remarkable. And then the other one then is a tiny little fragment which we're very grateful to the Abbey of Saint Maurice de Gone, which we're borrowing, and it's a little fragment that was on a reliquary, and it has the names of Saint Bridget, Deir Ludoc, who's her successor in Kildare, and Bishop Cunlad, again from Kildare. And this tiny little fragment of vellum was associated with a reliquary, probably, which had been deposited at the last point that pilgrims pass through before they ascend into the kind of Alpine Pass and kind of undertake their treacherous journey down into Italy, probably on their way to Rome. And it's just such a kind of remarkable fragment to these kind of perilous journeys, with the kind of precious cargo.
And a final point, it is extraordinary the way some of the scribes on some of the books, they're writing their jokes and their comments and their little asides. They're not just copying slavishly and making sure that it's all perfect. They're including their own personality.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, there's kind of two instances of that. And most of them are in the Priscian manuscript where they're talking about there's an ohm comment about being hungover. So that's obviously after a heavy night on the ale. And then there are also comments about, you know, it's getting very cold, or they're looking for forgiveness for the quality of their writing, the poverty of the ink they're using, and, you know, and that it's getting dark as well, you know, so they're running out of time to complete their comments. And there's also another complaint by an Irish monk who's in St. Gallen, and he's complaining about how the Irish are treated by their contemporaries in the Abbey, and he's not happy that the kind of Irish are being fully acknowledged for their kind of great contribution. So it's full of these kind of touches of personality alongside great works of learning.
Well, the exhibition Words on the Wave, Ireland and St. Gallen in Early Medieval Europe. It's running until the 24th of October.
Yeah.
Admission is free, Kildare Street, the National Museum of Ireland. And my thanks to Matthew Seaver, the Assistant Keeper at the National Museum of Ireland, for joining us tonight to talk about it. We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back, we're Talking History. A new exhibition at Dublin Castle offers a fresh lens on one of the most intriguing figures in Ireland's artistic and cultural history. Not the revolutionary countess, but her husband, Kazimierz Markiewicz. A Polish artist, theatre maker and towering presence in more ways than one, Kazimierz was a fixture of Dublin's bohemian art scene between 1903 and 1913. And the new exhibition is co-created by art historian Dr. Catherine Milligan, and who joins me now to talk about Kazimierz Constance and the European currents running through early 20th century Dublin. And the exhibition is Kazimierz Markiewicz, a Polish artist in Bohemian Dublin. Catherine, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a wonderful exhibition, and it has a wonderful exhibition booklet as well with all of the details. I want to start off though with maybe the image that we have of Kazimierz Markiewicz, because I think we normally see him as being maybe a bit of a rogue or a scoundrel or a kind of a bad un who mm-hmm. who she married, and because we know that it was an unhappy marriage, and his reputation, I wouldn't have realised that he was this talented artist. He's usually seen as maybe a bit of a scoundrel.
Yes, that's a really interesting perception, and one I think we will hopefully challenge a little bit with this exhibition. Yes, their marriage was brief, but they actually never divorced. They stay married throughout their life and certainly have a very warm friendship throughout both of their lives. But Casimir, he's in Dublin for quite a brief period, really about 10 years from 1903 to 1913. And while he's here, he's really involved in so many things of that time. And so by looking at it, we do get this sense that he was great fun. He was a great networker, I think we will call him now. He wants to be involved. He wants to get to know Irish cultural figures and be involved in everything that's happening in the city at that time. And of course, he was a fantastic painter, as you say, as well. Whereas we haven't really seen that much of his work, other, you know, he is represented in many of Ireland's galleries. But to really bring him out of her shadow a little bit is what we're hoping to do with the exhibition.
And he was a large figure. He was 6'4", so he was an imposing figure on the art scene.
Absolutely. I mean, they both were, Constance was also about 6 foot, so we have to picture them as this very tall, glamorous, striking couple when they came to Dublin in 1903. And yes, we have two wonderful cartoons by Beatrice Elvery, another important artist from that time, showing Casimir at the United Arts Club, and it is a caricature, but she really emphasises his height and how he towers over even figures like Yeats, William Orpin, and he's right there in the centre of that world.
And they met in Paris at art school, mm-hmm. and they were enrolled in the same place, but I think they had to attend separate studios. And tell us about that and mm-hmm. how that relationship began.
So they both were studying art at the Académie Julienne in Paris, which was one of the places for artists to go from all over the world in the late 19th century. So many Irish artists would have gone there, for example, Sarah Purser and others before Constance goes there in the late 1890s. It was a very similar situation for artists in Poland. So Casimir would have been part of quite a large Polish community there. They, just because of the time that it was, men and women studied in different rooms. They would have worked from the nude model. So there was some very, I suppose, 19th century propriety around there. But Paris was full of art students. There's lots of parties, exhibitions, people are meeting, and they actually meet at a dance, and it's their height that kind of flings them together. It's quite a whirlwind romance. Casimir was recently widowed when they meet, and he has a young son, but they become engaged quite quickly. Constance writes to tell her family, who are immediately quite surprised, but we have a wonderful letter where she writes to her brother, Jocelyn, and says, you know, he's a foreigner, but he's not French. And this is seen as quite a bonus. And she says that he's a very talented artist. He's exhibiting his work. And we really get this sense from the letter that she is smitten with him as well.
Can we resolve the issue about whether he actually was a count and whether then she was a countess? Because that seems to have occupied and preoccupied historians for many a year.
It certainly has. And you know what? I think it's still being debated now. There's some evidence to say, yes, he was entitled to use the title, and others that weren't. So it's a very contested issue. But certainly there's no changing the fact that they were known as the count and countess at the time.
And then they come to Dublin, and it's really such an extraordinary period in terms of Irish history, in terms of the literature, art, theatre, politics, and he's very much part of that and very much an innovator as well.
So we have this great sense from George Russell AE, that wonderful figure in early 20th century Irish cultural history, who says, you know, this couple are coming back to Ireland, and I really hope they're going to help us kind of shake things up, that they will help us find a new sense of Irish art. And it's very tied into the kind of literary and artistic revival that's going on at this period, and they really do get stuck in. So they are part of the wider movement to ensure that Hugh Lane's gallery opens, that the pictures stay in Ireland. Now, Casimir, he chairs committee meetings. You know, he's not afraid of the grunt work, I suppose, and then also serves on the committee for the foundation of the United Arts Club, so which was so important. While all that's going on, they're still very much part of the Dublin Castle Society circles as well. They're attending balls. And then as time goes on, as we head towards 1913, obviously for Constance, that really doesn't reconcile with where she wants to go with her political work as well. But for that brief period, they're right in there with everyone.
And he's someone who has certainly very strong views about politics, about freedom, given that what had happened to Poland and Russian rule. And he really believed that individuals and countries should be able to decide for themselves what happened.
Absolutely. He very strongly supported Polish independence. And while he leaves Ireland, really, as Constance becomes more political, they support and share each other's endeavours in achieving the best possible situation for their individual countries.
So tell us about what the exhibition is showing then. What's available and how good an artist was he?
So the exhibition really tells the story of that period, 1903 to 1913. So we start in Paris with this fabulous portrait that Casimir paints of Constance the year before they marry. Some listeners might know it. It's called The Artist's Wife. It's from the National Gallery of Ireland. And that really kind of sets the scene for their relationship. We then go through their time in Dublin, his involvement in theatre, their time in Dublin Castle. We've got two really beautiful portraits, one of Eleanor Duncan, who was another hugely influential figure in terms of the visual arts in early 20th century Ireland, and also George Russell as well. We then have a really interesting room which looks at the time that they spent in Ukraine, which is where Casimir's family had their estate. And there's paintings there by both Constance and Casimir, because of course we maybe forget that Constance was also a painter. They very much paint together, to the point where even now, after looking at their work for over a year, I still have to go, is that by Casimir or is that by Constance? But they're very much interested in the life of the labourers and people working in that region. And then the last room really brings it to a close. Their last meeting, which was as Constance was dying, and then the work that Casimir does when he returns to Poland after 1913. His work, like many artists, I suppose he can have good days and bad days, like us all. But I think overall people will be really surprised with the quality of his portraiture and his landscapes as well. There's some really sensitive depictions of kind of weather effects, atmospheric effects, really coming from that training in Paris and what he would have seen there.
And what about his work then with the theatre? Because there seems to be a real theatricality to him in terms of how he lived and dressed and worked, but also in the kinds of art he was producing.
So, I mean, one abiding thing that comes across in the material that we have about Casimir is that he loved fun. You know, he was really up for a party. One of his first theatrical roles in Dublin is actually playing the Pirate King in an amateur production of Pirates of Penzance. But of course, so many people were interested in theatre at that time. We have these little groups popping up all over the city, and he does as well. He writes a number of plays. Probably the most significant of those is The Memory of the Dead, which is about the 1798 Rebellion. His plays, of course, star Constance as a leading lady. But then he also brought some kind of other international plays to the city as well, including the works of George Bernard Shaw. So he was trying to offer something maybe perhaps a little bit different to other theatre companies, much to the chagrin of W.B. Yeats at times. But it reminds us that there is a plurality of kind of theatrical voices in the city at that time.
And very much a kind of, it's interesting as we look at it as Europeans as well as Irish people, that there's this very strong European dimension to what was happening in this art scene at the time, but also that he was bringing with his own perspectives.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when we think about where they met, they meet in Paris. Initially, they mainly spoke to each other in French. That was their shared language. And so when they come back to Dublin, you have Hugh Lane obviously trying to create this space for French modernist painting in Ireland. And it's this aspect of the cultural revival that is very outward looking and trying to connect Ireland to a wider European artistic sensibility at the time. When you think of even the journey that Casimir would have made several times from his home in Ukraine, back to Paris, to Ireland. He's, you know, probably one of quite few figures in Ireland who can bring that wealth of experience and show what these different landscapes look like through his painting. So I think he's quite unusual in that respect.
So how long is the exhibition running for?
The exhibition is open until the 14th of September in the State Department Galleries in Dublin Castle.
And how exciting has it been to work on it, to try and, you know, I suppose, bring to life, bring to public attention something that is significant, something that was so significant at the time, but has been kind of forgotten about. So it's reclaiming an important part of our artistic and cultural heritage.
It's been just a wonderful exhibition to work on. And I think something that's really stood out is the generosity of many of our lenders. So whether that was the kind of Casimir's descendants who live in Poland today, we've had a really wonderful time meeting them and they've really generously shared works with us. Lissadel House have also been incredibly generous with their time and sharing their paintings with us for the exhibition, and so many of Ireland's cultural institutions as well. And I will say, when we first approached people, always the immediate reaction was one of excitement and delight that Casimir was going to get his moment.
Well, it's a brilliant new exhibition running at Dublin Castle. Casimir Markovic, a Polish artist in Bohemian Dublin. And it's co-created by art historian Dr. Catherine Milligan. And Catherine, thanks so much for joining us tonight to discuss it.
You're very welcome. A pleasure to be here.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Making fashion decisions when you're in the spotlight is no easy task. Fortunately, Queen Elizabeth had several decades of practice. From her first formal dresses as a child to her ball gowns and the signature coats and hats she wore in her later years.
The thing about Queen Elizabeth is that I don't know that she was interested in fashion, but she understood the power of clothes and the role of clothes in her royal duties. She developed this wardrobe that she was sort of known for, right? A working wardrobe of colorful styles. But it was fashion too, because she played with color, she played with textures, she played with different embellishments on her hat, and it turned her into this like brightly colored, delightful grandma figure.
The Kate effect is still very much in effect. When Catherine wears something, it almost immediately sells out.
On her wedding day, Elizabeth wore her mother-in-law, Queen Mary's veil, rather than a tiara. Her gown, designed by Seymour Handley, featured gold and pearl medieval-style embroidery and is considered a masterpiece of couture. For the first time, a royal bride broke tradition with a loose, straight gown featuring a dropped waist and two modest trains, setting a unique style in royal wedding history.
I was a bit neurotic at the time of the making of the royal wedding dress, and I thought, what happens if somebody breaks in and steals the dress, or something spills, or there's a fire, or it gets stolen? I wanted to be prepared for any emergency, and we set about making this other dress, not exactly like the royal wedding dress, because to try and recreate that would have just taken too long. And we were a tiny little studio.
No, there was no one truly like Princess Diana, right? And this is the biggest sale of her belongings since 1997. So what was it about her? What made her such a style icon?
Because she was a kind, caring, compassionate, loving person, approachable, likable. We need more people like Diana in the world. Sadly, we lost her in 1997. We only knew Diana for 16 years. 28 years later, we're still talking about her, how relevant she was, how stylish and elegant she was.
Welcome back. We're Talking History. I'm delighted to be joined now by Claudia Acott-Williams, the creator of a brilliant new exhibition at Hillsborough Castle called Royal Style in the Making. And it unveils the intimate bond between royal clients and fashion designers and discovers how the British fashion industry crafted the iconic style of the royal women. And Claudia, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us about this exhibition, Royal Style in the Making. Tell us about how you put it together and, I suppose, its wider significance.
Well, historic royal palaces are the fortunate custodians of the Royal Ceremonial Dress Collection, which is a designated collection of international significance and the sort of largest collection of British royal ceremonial and court dress. And, you know, we're fascinated by the pageantry, of course, as everyone is, but we're also hugely interested in the people behind the pageantry. You know, who are the incredibly talented craftspeople that are creating the looks that we are familiar with through iconic photos of royalty? And so, as well as celebrating those extraordinary garments that we see, you know, on television and in the news, we wanted to sort of go behind the scenes and take our visitors behind the scenes to really understand, you know, how these looks were made and who are these sort of extraordinary people behind them. And we're very fortunate in the dress collection to have, as well as historic garments, extensive archives of design drawings, appointment books, order books, and lots of material that helps us understand how these garments are made. So that's sort of where it came from. We wanted to understand and get to know the people behind the pageantry.
And it tells a really interesting story because it shows how fashion was used as a tool of statecraft, that there are important things that are coming out by looking at the fashion.
Absolutely. I think, you know, we're all incredibly familiar with the faces of the royal women of the 20th century. And I think we have a sense that we know them and we know what they stand for. But actually, it's very rare that we hear them talk, and most of their communication is non-verbal. And huge amounts of that is delivered through their clothing. So what's extraordinary about these designers is they're not only required to consider, you know, sort of practical things like climate and, you know, cultures and customs of places where they're visiting, but they're also required really to communicate quite sort of subtle but important messages through the clothing. You know, so that might be a sort of acknowledgement or compliment to the host by adapting their national emblems, for example, in a piece of jewellery or sort of woven into the clothing, or their national colours. Or it might be at a grand ceremonial occasion, an acknowledgement that they are head of state, not just of the United Kingdom, but also of, you know, the Commonwealth. And so inclusion of their sort of emblems into the clothing that they're wearing.
And you have something from the coronation of Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. So the coronation from 1937.
That's right, we do. So this is a sort of extraordinary object. It's not really a garment, because what it is, it's a toile. And the toile is a preparatory garment. I sort of think of it as a 3D sketch. So it's the moment between initial design and finished garment. And it's how the designer takes that design and works it into 3D, tailors it to the body of the wearer, in this case, Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, and also sort of thinks through the embellishment and the embroidery. So it's an extraordinary thing. It's made of calico, and it has a sort of hand-painted gold embroidery design on it, but it also has little tacking stitches that show where it, you know, where she's sort of sculpting it to the Queen Mother's body, and you can see her thought process as she sort of moves patches of embroidery around, as she takes up the neckline slightly, as she makes the straps a bit thicker, probably to hold the heavy robes that would have accompanied this dress. So it's really a working garment. And it helps us to understand how a 2D drawing is brought to life.
And it is incredible to hear about the design process and to hear about that relationship and the kind of the back and forth about how it does get designed. And you really also get to see a lot about the kind of the politics and the symbolism and what national symbolism they want to have sewn into the royal garments and what they consider significant and important.
Yes, absolutely. So we talk quite a lot, in particular, about the work of Norman Hartnell in designing the coronation gown and the wedding gown for Queen Elizabeth II. The extraordinary amount of research that he does to ensure that both of those garments have a sort of heavy symbolism woven into them. So he, for the wedding, her wedding in 1947, you see that he goes around the galleries of London and he finds a painting, Primavera by Botticelli, to lift emblems and motifs from. And that's all about the idea of kind of rebirth and renewal after the Second World War. This is the first sort of big ceremonial occasion after the Second World War, and the idea is that it should be really uplifting and bring joy to a still rather beleaguered nation. And then similarly for her coronation in 1953, he does huge amounts of research into the national emblems of all the Commonwealth countries. And there's a sort of a bit of back and forth about whether or not Wales should be a daffodil or a leek. And his initial design for a daffodil is rejected and replaced by a leek. And it's the most beautiful embroidered leek you've ever seen. But similarly, he does huge amounts of research into sort of heraldry, the history of coronation ceremonies, right back to the medieval period. So, you know, there's nothing accidental in these garments. It's all hugely considered and enormously well researched.
And there is an evening dress that was designed for Queen Elizabeth II in 1979. And tell us about the design. Tell us about the designer. And also the fact that it was an item that she liked so much, she wore on many occasions.
Yes, that's right. So this sort of wonderful chiffon evening dress is designed for her by a very important 20th century British designer called Sir Hardy Ames. And Hardy Ames, along with Norman Hartnell, is one of the Queen's official dressmakers. He designs for her for over 50 years. So they develop a real relationship of kind of trust and understanding, which is something that you see often among particularly royal women in the 20th century, this sort of long-standing patronage of a small number of designers that really come to understand the very particular requirements of royal dress. What's interesting about Hardy Ames is that he was actually, he sort of began as a tailor on Savile Row. And then he graduated to doing sort of lovely evening gowns. And that's where he starts designing for Queen Elizabeth II. And this dress is a really interesting example of his sort of design ingenuity. So it's a kind of a coral chiffon. It's wonderfully sort of floating. It has that bat wing silhouette, which is typical of the 1970s, surprisingly sort of fashionable for the Queen, who very deliberately did not want to sort of doggedly follow fashion. But you know, it's an acknowledgement of the time in which she reigns and a kind of need to show that she is up to date, which is sort of required in the 1970s in particular. It's a wonderful combination of sort of really spectacular tailoring and beautiful fitting, whilst being sort of ethereal and light and floating. It's got long sleeves and a high neckline, which was required, to fit the customs of her host, which was Bahrain. But yes, as you say, she wears it on several occasions. Including to a film premiere in London a couple of months after her trip to Bahrain, and then on several occasions, we know, privately. So it was certainly a particular favourite for her, as were most of his clothes. He was described as being stylish but practical in his approach, and he's really credited for sort of bringing her look up to date. Norman Hartnell adopts a very sort of traditional crinoline silhouette that sort of harks back to the Victorian period in his approach after the abdication of Edward VIII, where they're trying to sort of re-establish a sense of the long tradition of monarchy. And Hardy Ames then in the 1960s and the 1970s sort of pulls the Queen into the present time and ensures that she reflects the time in which she reigns. And is seen to represent a kind of modern monarchy. So he introduces much brighter colours to ensure that she can be seen in public, and these sort of more contemporary silhouettes. And this is a really brilliant example of that.
You also have some interesting sketches for designs for Princess Diana.
We do. We have an extraordinary collection of sketches which were created for her by the company Belleville Sassoon, which was a collaboration between a woman called Belinda Belleville, who was a sort of long-standing society designer, and then a younger designer called David Sassoon, who came in and sort of really shook up the house and modernized it for a kind of younger generation of high society women, really. He was a particular favourite, or they were a particular favourite of Diana, Princess of Wales, in the 1980s, so in the first decade of her marriage. And what's so wonderful about these sketches, and similarly about some of the Norman Hartnell sketches for Queen Elizabeth II, is they really show the sort of kind of personal contact between designer and royal client. So many of the Diana sketches are annotated with little handwritten notes in Diana's hand saying, you know, oh, yes, please, but can I have it in pink? Or yes, but with long sleeves, please. So you get a sense of that sort of collaborative approach and exchange of ideas between designer and royal client. And they also show, you know, the very first imaginings of some really well-known Diana garments. So there's one dress in particular which she called her caring dress, and it's a little sort of a little short day dress which is very brightly coloured florals, and she wore this on visits to things like hospitals or children's hospitals, anything where she wanted to appear kind of particularly warm, friendly and approachable. And what's interesting about the design is that David Sassoon is sort of initially following royal protocol, and he creates the original design with a hat, which was, and with gloves, which was customary for royal women. But that's where Diana really sort of broke the rules of royal dressing. And in fact, she rarely wore hats, and she said no thank you to the hat, because she felt that they created a bit of a barrier between her and the people that she was meeting, similarly with gloves. And instead, she often wore, with this particular dress, sort of big, chunky costume jewellery. And if she picked up children, they liked playing with it. So it's very interesting to see, you know, how she was taking these designs by a quite established society designer, and then kind of ripping up the rule book and making them her own.
Ripping up the rule book and making them her own. And some of the designers had backgrounds in theatre, and that seems to have been a big influence in some of their work, and it maybe helped them design something that suited the person they were making it for, like in the case of Princess Margaret.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's critical in a way. Royal dress, you know, we always say when we're talking about the Royal Ceremonial Dress Collection, it's not a fashion. It's not a representation of fashion, of changing fashion. It's a much more performative mode of dress. It's designed deliberately to communicate both, you know, a long history and tradition, and to show them as people of the day, and also to communicate where they sort of can't verbally, as we've said. So I think it's no coincidence at all that many of the designers that worked with the royal women, again, particularly in the 20th century, were also designers for stage and screen. And we have a really extraordinary dress on display, which is, in fact, a fancy dress costume, which was designed by Oliver Messel, who was one of the country's leading theatre designers from the 1930s to the 1960s. In fact, Princess Margaret first saw one of his ballets, A Midsummer Night's Dream, in 1938 when she was a little girl. And then as a grown woman, she married his nephew, Anthony Armstrong Jones, later Lord Snowden. And the two became really, really firm friends. And the dress we have on display actually is the only example of a gown designed by Oliver Messel for Princess Margaret, though he did design her house in Mustique and various other things for her. And you know, if your sort of uncle-in-law was one of the greatest designers of stage and screen, then you would ask him to design a fancy dress costume for you. And this dress is kind of more Georgian than the Georgians in many ways, and was worn for a charity ball in 1964.
And Claudia, I wonder, are you a fan of The Crown? Do you watch that? And when you watch it, do you criticise the outfits that they're wearing as being historically inaccurate?
That's a good question. I am a fan of The Crown. I think it's, you know, obviously there is always creative license in these things, and there sort of needs to be. It is a fictional account of the history of the monarchy, and that's something we should all remember. But in general, I would say the production values across the board are really exceptional on The Crown, and the costume design in particular is brilliant and sort of incredibly well observed. And, you know, of course, there are details which aren't completely accurate or perfect, but I think that in a creation of fiction, that is sort of permissible and actually perhaps even preferable, just to clearly distinguish, an act of fiction from a sort of documentary. But by and large, I would say that it's you know, really well considered. And actually, I was fortunate to attend a sale of an auction sale of sets and costumes from The Crown, and was able to see a lot of the costumes up close, and they are beautifully made.
Beautifully made. Well, you can see more beautifully made costumes and dresses and designs at Hillsborough Castle. The exhibition is open now. It's running until January next year.
That's right.
And you get to see the castle and you get to see the gardens as well with your ticket.
Yes, you do. And it's a spectacular place full of some of the greatest examples of 20th century Irish art. So really, really worth a look.
Very good. And an important building and an important site for Irish history as well, and diplomatic history and more besides. So a wonderful new exhibition there, Royal Style in the Making. And I was delighted there to be talking to the creator of the exhibition, Claudia Acott-Williams. Claudia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you ever so much for having me.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.